Expat Files with John Mueller, Mondays and Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, not the version they give you in those glossy travel magazines or the picture they paint for you in those international traveler websites where they're only trying to sell you something. What's it really like for expats living in Latin America? Well, it's time to take off those rose-colored glasses and find out. So let's get started. Now, for all you people who have been down to Latin America, I'm sure you've noticed that almost no one ever stops for a stop sign. Never completely, anyway, unless someone's passing right in front of you, and if you don't stop, you'll hit them. The thing is, Latin drivers treat stop signs like yellow lights. They just slow down a little bit, and if no one's in the way, they just blast on through. And the same's true with police and government vehicles, too. Who should know better, of course. But that's the way it is, so you'll have to watch out for that if you're driving down here. And here's the funny thing. I've never seen or heard of anyone who's ever gotten a ticket for running a stop sign, even though everyone does it. And because of that, it's always a big joke amongst expats down here. They always say, and I've heard it 100 times, if the policía tránsito, the traffic cops, if they just enforced 2 of the most common traffic violations that they never enforce, of course. Well, if they did and they handed out fines, within 6 months, they'd probably balance the budget and actually have a surplus in any of the Latin countries that tried it. And as a secondary effect, there would be a lot less car accidents and, of course, pedestrians getting trampled and killed. And there are 2 special traffic offenses everybody gets away with. Number 1, of course, being running stop signs. The second being missing taillights and headlights, often both at the same time. And that includes government vehicles, police vehicles, and hospital vehicles like ambulances and supply vehicles, too. Sometimes they're the worst offenders. Anyway, up where I come from in Chicago, when you roll through a stop sign, they call that the Chicago roll, which by definition means you don't come to a complete stop. And first world traffic cops have their eyes wide open for that. In fact, I've gotten 2 or 3 tickets myself doing a Chicago roll. And you don't forget something like that because it costs you a few $100 and a few points off your license. Up in the first world, of course. But down here, you'd be simply amazed what drivers get away with right in front of the traffic cops. It's as if they just hired these guys one day, put uniforms on them, and sent them out on the streets with whistles and batons, and said, okay, you're now traffic cops, and you're on your own. It seems like not one of them knows exactly what's legal and what's not. And I know that for a fact because a few times I've been caught going the wrong way down a one-way street. And with my luck, it usually happens right in front of a cop. Now, if I was in the first world, I'd be stuck with a $200 or $300 fine for sure and some points off my license. But down here, most often the cops just shake their finger at you, nod their head, and give you a funny look. And soon enough, you figure out you're going in the wrong direction. And going the wrong way down a one-way street doesn't happen because you're an idiot driver. Not down here. Anyhow, I don't like to think of myself that way. So if not for idiot drivers, then what? It's because the streets are marked so badly, or just not marked at all. Not to mention that the traffic people are always changing the direction and the flow of the traffic because the cities, especially the big cities down here, are so overburdened with cars and trucks, and the roads so narrow and under-designed for the traffic flow that during the morning and evening rush hour, they'll often steal a lane of traffic from the opposing direction and mark it off with a line of those orange cones or pylons. And they think by doing that, they're helping the bottleneck. At least, that's what they think they're doing, but it almost never works out that way. In other words, you could be driving all day long on a 4-lane highway. That means 2 lanes for your direction and 2 lanes for the opposing traffic, right? Then all of a sudden, at 5 or 5:30 in the afternoon, you'll go down that same road and see 3 lanes of traffic coming right at you, with no advance warning whatsoever, except for a few fluorescent pylons and traffic cones. Suddenly, they've stolen an entire lane of traffic and given it to the cars coming in the other direction. There's no signs or warnings telling you that if you don't hug the right lane, you're going to get whacked head on. And that's the reason, besides the massive potholes, of course, that there are so many traffic accidents down here and so many cars going off the road. The fact is, down here in a big city during rush hour, you can't drive for an hour on a busy road and not see some jumble of cones diverting traffic into one direction or another, always in a haphazard way and in a direction that traffic was never designed to go in the first place. So all I'm saying to all you people who do visit down here, when driving in the city, don't get too comfortable and complacent when the road seems good and the traffic's flowing nicely. Because if you're not really attentive and the transit cops have decided to change the traffic pattern again, if you're a daydreamer, you just might slam into a pylon or two, or even worse. And to tell you the truth, I've run down a few traffic cones myself. So if the cops don't give you a ticket for not having lights on your car at night, and they don't give you a ticket for going the wrong way down a one-way street, and they don't give you tickets for running red lights and stop signs and speeding, and here's a big one, they don't even give you a ticket if you're in a car accident and you're the one who's obviously at fault, even if your car isn't roadworthy at all. So if you can break practically every traffic law, what do you have to look out for when it comes to traffic law enforcement and the cops? When will they give you a ticket? Well, for one thing, they'll give you a ticket if you don't have plates on your car. Now, that's a no-brainer, right? But it seems the only time you'll even get a ticket for that is if a cop's directly behind you in a police cruiser and one of the cops in the vehicle actually notices it. But the chances are, he won't. And the second way they'll get you if you don't have plates is when they put up some pylons and you have to go through a police roadblock. Which, like I said in a previous show, that's the way the police prefer to pull you over 95% of the time. Most of all because they're rationed to 1 or 2 gallons of gasoline a day. So, they're not at all into high-speed chases. And no one has the equipment to run your plates directly right there, like they do in the States. And that's why most of the time down here, you'll see those police cruisers pulled over in gas stations and in empty lots, and the guys inside just sitting there relaxing, reading the paper, drinking a cup of coffee, or gabbing away on a cell phone. And by the way, when the cops are parked in some spot just waiting and waiting for something to happen, you'll almost always see at least one of them on a cell phone. And that's because down here, the police are issued cell phones by the government, and the talking time is free. And of course, the cell phone is only supposed to be used for police business, but no one follows that rule either because there's no oversight and nobody checks. It's one of the perks of being a cop or a mid to high level government worker, functionary, or bureaucrat down here. And by the way, that's another reason why every Latin wants to get a government job. Those free phone privileges. So in effect, you could be driving down the road with no seatbelts, no bumpers, no lights, a broken windshield, and blowing smoke out of your tailpipe like a volcano. And you're not going to get pulled over and ticketed. And even if they flag you down at one of those police stops, as long as your papers are in order, that is, you have current plates and your license is okay and the car is registered, well, they just wave you on your way. But in reference to what I just said, I'm talking about the way the transit cops do things in the 95% of the places that aren't in the high-volume tourist areas. Now, in the tourist areas like Costa Rica, parts of Mexico like Cancun, and Panama, it's a lot different. They're still not into high-speed chases because they're running on a few gallons a day of rationed gasoline too. But if they pull you over at one of those police stops, they'll be sizing you up all right to squeeze a little blood out of you if they can, especially if you're a first-world tourist, because they know you've got the deep pockets. And meanwhile, when the cop's going over the paperwork on your car, looking for defects, and deciding which one he's going to write you a ticket on, or threaten to write you a ticket on to elicit a bribe, while you're standing there watching the traffic go by, I guarantee you're going to see a couple of dozen cars go by with multiple safety violations, all of them much worse than what your transit cop's going to ticket you for. But when traveling off the tourist track, in the 95% of the rest of Latin America, it's very unlikely that you'll be singled out as a deep-pocket tourist. You're only ripe for the picking when you're in a tourist area. So when you're driving around Latin America, the only thing you have to really remember is to have license plates on your car, a certified copy of the registration in your glove compartment, or a certified copy of the title, and it's your lawyer that'll do those certified copies in like 10 minutes, so it's no problem. And if you use a rental car company, they handle all that for you, so you don't have to worry about a thing. And by the way, down here, it's very unwise to carry the original papers with you. By that, I mean the original title and the circulation. Now, the circulation is a little plastic card that looks like a credit card that has the owner's name and the car model and the engine numbers on it and a few other pertinent things. And the reason why you should never carry that in your car or on your person and instead have your lawyer make a certified copy is because if someone steals that car and they have that original circulation in their hand or the original title, they can cross a border with that and the officials on the border will ask no questions as someone passes through, not if they have original paperwork like that. Now, you might ask when you go through the border, if you show those papers and the registration isn't a different name than yours, aren't the border officials going to get suspicious and stop you and start asking questions? Because you're going to have to show them an ID to get that car through, and of course that car's original circulation and or the title. Ah, but there's a loophole there. Of course you'll be able to drive it right through if it's in your name, but what if that car's in someone else's name, like your brother or your uncle, or it's in the name of a business? Well, here's how you do it. You see, you can take a vehicle across a border in Latin America if you have an original title or original circulation, if you have a piece of paper from a lawyer saying that you have permission to drive that car. It certifies that the owner gave you permission to drive it. And the guys at the border will accept a paper like that as long as it's on lawyer stationery and it has the proper stamps, seals, and signatures from a lawyer, and a paragraph saying that you have permission from the owner to drive it. And of course, down here, it's very, very easy to go into a lawyer's office and pay him to make up such a paper. They do it all the time and don't ask many questions about it, not even thinking that perhaps something illegal is going on using that paper. They don't worry about that, because 999 out of 1,000 times, a paper like that is necessary and used for something completely legitimate. Because so many people, especially in the middle classes, borrow each other's trucks and cars. So if someone legitimately borrowing a car gets stopped by the cops or tries to drive it through a border, the papers and the permission must be in order. For example, if a young kid is moving out of the house into an apartment, he'll call up his Uncle Julio, who has a beat-up old pickup truck, and he'll ask him if he can use it this Saturday and Sunday. And Uncle Julio will say, okay, just come on over and get it and fill it up with gas. Now, if Uncle Julio doesn't have the same last name as the kid who's borrowing that truck, the kid will have to go to a lawyer and get one of those certified papers and carry it around with him, saying that he has permission from Uncle Julio to drive his truck. Because if he gets pulled over for any reason or gets in an accident, and the police notice that his name is completely different than the one on the certified title or the certified circulation paper, it doesn't matter if he says, hey, that's my uncle, or next-door neighbor, or whoever. The cops are going to assume that the vehicle has been stolen. But the cops will never press the point if you have the same last name as the guy on the certified copy of the title or the circulation. So family members with the same last names don't need papers like that. So anyway, as you can imagine, there are a lot of these certified documents and papers floating around. And as you might imagine, it's easy to get false certified papers. Because down here, a little money buys a lot of grease with a lawyer. And that's why you should never have the original copies of the title or the circulation card in your car. Only certified copies. Because the border cops know in every country not to let anyone drive on through unless they have those original papers. The only certified copy you need when you go through a border is a certified copy of the permission slip from the original owner if the car is not in your name. Now, I know that sounds a little complicated and redundant, and it is the first few times you try it. And that's another reason why you need a lawyer. They know how to do all of that stuff, and you won't have to do a thing. And that, my friends, is another reason they call it the third world. They're just loaded down with so much extraneous paperwork like that, such a mountain of duplicates and triplicates in every lawyer's office, police station, and customs and border office, that I'm really surprised that there's any rainforest left down here at all. But by now I'm sure you're wondering, what does a certified copy like that cost when you go down to your lawyer's office? Probably around $10, since his secretary's the one that does all the work, and he just signs on the dotted line on the bottom of the page. So even though you have to do a lot of running around, at least it's cheap. And there's one saving grace, at least you don't have to get a new one every time you borrow someone's car. You just need one lawyer-certified piece of paper and that's it. You can keep it on you or in the glove compartment and it lasts forever. Anyway, I do have a few suggestions for keeping out of trouble when driving a car down here. First, of course, make sure you wear your seatbelts. And by the way, you'll find that less than half of the driving population down here actually do use a seatbelt. And when you're talking about older cars, 10, 15, and 20 years old, and that's most of the cars down here, a good majority of them don't even have seatbelts. Well, they did once, but they don't anymore. Sure, they came equipped with them all right, but after 5 or 6 owners, somewhere along the way, they were a big enough annoyance to one of the owners that they just took them out. So in a lot of these older cars, you couldn't use them if you wanted. But the Latins with the newer cars, the ones that are 5 years old or newer, most of those people do use their seatbelts. Not because they want to, but because of that stupid buzzer that goes off if you don't. And mechanics have cottoned on to the fact that people hate those buzzers. In fact, any mechanic down here for about $5 will disconnect your wires so you won't have to listen to that thing anymore. And I first noticed this when I got into a late model taxi down here and my bottled water rolled under the front seat. It was nighttime when he dropped me off at my hotel and I looked under the front seat to find it with my little flashlight keychain and I saw a jumble of frayed wires under the seat. And this taxi was not even a year old, I'm sure. And I looked at the guy and I said, I think you have a wiring problem under your seat. Maybe you should take a look at it. And he said, no, I just disconnected the seatbelt buzzers. But I think he disconnected a lot more than that. Looked like he took a garden shears to that wiring harness. Oh well, you get the idea. Oh, and another thing, when you buy a new car down here, they almost always come with airbags, because that's standard in the first world, and they ship these cars down here based on first world standards. That's true with all the new cars anyway. But you should know that if you buy a used car down here, that's supposed to have functional airbags, and there's an airbag logo somewhere on your dashboard to prove it. Well, even if that car's lightly used and only a few months old, don't be so sure that those airbags are going to work if you get into an accident, especially if you buy a late model used car that's had a fender bender or two. Most of the time, when you're in an accident and you've been going over 5 miles an hour, the airbags deploy. Now, up in the first world, I know that it's law that if you buy a used car from a dealer, those airbags have to work. And if you buy a car from a private party up in the first world, there's an easy way to check it. You just go over to the dealership, and the mechanic plugs in a diagnostic cable, and in 2 seconds, they'll tell you if the airbags are functional. And usually, it's much easier to tell than that. You just look at the dashboard, and if there's an idiot light on that has an airbag symbol, then the airbag's already been deployed, and you need to get it fixed. And the bad news is, it's going to cost you anywhere from $800 to $2,000 to repair, up in the first world, that is. So naturally, that means down here in the third world, practically no one ever has them restored to working condition. And in fact, no one seems to care. I mean, when you got more than half the population that doesn't even use seat belts, airbags haven't even made it to the wish list. And to tell you the truth, most Latin drivers, even the wealthy ones, don't even know what they are. And you know, I've seen a lot of accidents down here, and there's always a gaper's block. You're stuck in a bottleneck going very slow, and sometimes you get a real close-up view of the damage done. Now, over the years, I've seen hundreds of accidents, and yet, even in a tight gaper's block, when I could see everything, I've never seen an airbag deployed. So the bottom line is, all you expats out there, when you buy a used car, I'll bet you 10 to 1 the airbags don't work. So don't get your hopes up. But don't get overly paranoid about it either. Your best bet, so that you never have to find out if your airbags work or not, is to be on the lookout for tailgaters and don't be one yourself. Tailgating down here is a national sport you should never engage in, even though everybody else does. Rear-end crashes are the number one source of accidents down here. And the thing is, if you follow driving school guidelines, they say you should keep one car length's distance behind the car in front of you for every 10 miles an hour that you're going. How's your memory? Do you remember that? In other words, if you're going 30, you should be 3 car lengths away from the guy in front of you. And since everything is set up in kilometers down here, if you're going 10 kilometers an hour, you should be at least 1 car length away from the guy in front of you. And if you're going 30 kilometers an hour, that's 3 car lengths away from the guy in front of you. So it turns out when you calculate things in kilometers, it's actually a better margin of safety than when you calculate them in miles. And if you follow those guidelines, whether it's in kilometers or miles per hour, you'll probably never end up rear-ending someone, even if the guy in front of you slams on the brakes. But here's the problem I see in the big cities down here in Latin America. If you're going 30 kilometers an hour, and you put 3 car lengths between you and the guy in front of you, like the driving instructors always tell you, I guarantee you within a minute or two, some anxious driver is going to try to wedge his way into that 3 car length safety space you've provided for yourself. And if you let that happen, you'll have to slow down and drop 3 car lengths behind that guy. Then, I guarantee you, in less than a minute, some guy's gonna spot that opening and whip himself right into that space, and now you got the same problem again. Suddenly, you're tailgating that guy, and you gotta drop back another 3 car lengths to give you that safety margin. So, as you can see, it just doesn't work. So down here, in the big cities at least, it's impossible to follow those hard and fast safety rules that they have in the driver's ed manuals. And if I remember right, when you take your driver's license test up in the first world, if you don't give the guy in front of you 1 car length for every 10 miles an hour, they'll flunk you for tailgating. And the other sad half of that equation is, there's always a guy tailgating you. A guy on your rear end, ready to smash into you if you slam on the brakes. And so far, that's happened to me about 3 or 4 times down here already. Which is a good reason not to have a late model car, or you'll find yourself forever running from one body shop to another. And I suppose that's another reason why, when you see a car that's just turning 1 year old, the body and the paint is never in tip-top shape again. It just can't happen down here. Which is another reason why there's so many beat-up old junkers down here. After a couple of years, people just give up on trying to keep their cars looking new. I know I did. And if you continue to have a first world mentality about that, you'll be frustrated all the time. The first thing you do when you go native is to let go of the thought of having a nice car. And I've noticed that when expats with resources first come down, They always seem to start off with a new car or a very nice late model car, and they keep it in great condition. And that goes on for a year or two, but after 3 or 4 years, they find it so hard to keep it in great condition, they always end up going at least a little bit native. In any event, they end up lowering their standards. And though their cars always seem to look better and cleaner than Latins who have similar cars, you can see little by little, expats become less anal retentive about their cars, which is a good thing. You never see long-term expats spit shining and polishing and waxing their cars on the front lawn on Sundays. You just don't see that kind of stuff down here. That is, of course, unless you have bodyguards, then you can tell them to do that for you. But like I mentioned in a previous show, expats, as a rule, just hate having bodyguards, even though they're forced into it sometimes. For example, if they have kids that hang around with other rich kids, and that often happens to expats who decide to live an opulent lifestyle. Because when down here, their money buys a lot more. And some expats do fall into that trap. In fact, I know some personally. But to me, and most other expats I know, that's like living in a gilded cage. It looks nice from the outside, but you don't have any privacy, and you feel kind of trapped. Now, to change the topic a little bit, last week I had the pleasure of speaking by Skype to the Richard Martin meetup group up in New Brunswick, USA. And though I think there were some technical problems and we had a pretty lousy Skype connection that day, they did lead off with some very good questions. And I thought some of those questions would be worth talking about on today's show and maybe some more questions they asked on next week's show too. For example, one of the guys in the group asked what it would be like to be an artist traveling around Latin America, hauling around his stuff in a Winnebago or a trailer, and stopping along the roadside in various towns and cities, displaying his stuff alongside the road and trying to sell it that way. And he said he fully realized you probably couldn't make a ton of money that way, but maybe he could make a living at it and just keep traveling and traveling, doing art, displaying it, and selling it that way. Well, I mentioned that's very possible, all right, because as you drive through Latin America, you see that every day, most often in the country roads and right outside of big cities. There'll be 2, 3, or 4 little trucks and cars pulled over with people selling artwork, antiques, fruits and vegetables, and sometimes even woven products, furniture, and things like leather jackets. And I'm sure no one actually gets permission to do that. They just pull alongside a busy road, usually near a gas station or a commercial center, and if it's artwork, they'll just lean it up against their car or trailer. Now, one thing is certain. You wouldn't want to do this kind of thing in Central America. That is, the countries from Panama up through Mexico. Forget about it in Central America. Unless you're going to locate in or near a high-volume tourist area, where everybody seems to be selling something or another to tourists. And of course, if you locate there, you'll have a good shot at catching some of those tourist dollars. But an area like that will be higher priced, so the cost of living will be higher, and there will be a lot more competition, so you better have something really unique to sell. Because you see, that seems to be the problem down here in tourist areas. It always happens that wherever there's a lot of tourists, there'll be 4 or 5 or 6 or even 10 people selling just about the same thing. Paintings of churches and colonial buildings, cobblestone streets with colorful horse-drawn wagons, sunset pictures of lakes and volcanoes, with a few toucans and birds of paradise thrown in. Now, I don't know if you want to call that art or not. I don't. It's more like paint by numbers. That's just the kind of junk they sell around tourist areas. And to tell you the truth, I don't know how these locals make a living at it, but tourists are gullible and they'll buy just about anything. Because after all, when they get home, they'll have to bring back something for everybody. You can't leave out little JJ, Uncle George, and the twins now, can you? So like I said, unless you have a unique product to sell, or a unique artistic style of some sort, it's going to be pretty tough going for an artist who's not hooked up with a gallery or a museum. Because all those street artists, even in the tourist areas, just seem to be scraping by. And those with a unique product always seem to do better. And the better ones always seem to end up in a gallery somewhere, which could sometimes double, triple, or even quadruple the price they get. Though eventually the competition tries to copy them too. Now, I remember 15 or 20 years ago when I first came down, I almost never saw a photo or a painting of a Spanish colonial weathered door or window. 20 years ago, no one was doing that. Now, they're everywhere. These days, you can go into little tourist galleries and see whole walls filled with pictures of nothing but painted doors and windows. And since so many local artists seem to be doing it, the prices are very cheap. So anyway, I'd rule out most of Central America for first world artists who want to come down and flog their stuff on the street. Unless they have a very unique product, and in that case, they could really make a decent living for themselves if they stick to the tourist areas. But then in the tourist areas, the cost of living is much higher than in the rest of Central America. And also, in some cases like Cancun and Costa Rica, almost approaching first world prices. And I don't think any of you want to come down to Latin America for that. But if you're an artist and you want to be mobile and plug your stuff out of a trailer or the trunk of a car, you could do it in a lot of places in South America. I'm talking South America now. Because like I said in a past show, South America is a very safe place, barring a few exceptions like Brazil, Venezuela, and some of the real big cities like Lima, Peru, where there are high crime rates and you wouldn't want to just pull up to any old corner and start hauling all your artwork out of your trunk, set up a stand, and start selling it. And who knows, you might be stepping on somebody's toes. But you could do that in most of the countries in South America, and you could probably make a halfway decent living at it, again, if you have a unique product, and you set up in or near a big city where there's a lot of middle and upper class traffic flow. Because the people who are going to buy your artwork are either going to be tourists or people in late model cars. People with the disposable income to buy your stuff. Now, another good idea for artists who want to come down here is to go to one of the big cities in South America that has a vibrant artistic cultural section. Cities with a lot of universities and art districts like Buenos Aires, Cartagena, Cali, Bogota, Viña del Mar in Chile. They all have hundreds of museums and galleries you can show at, and they have plenty of year-round art festivals. But if there's a lot of competition and you're doing much of the same kind of thing the locals are doing, you might not have much luck, though you always have that advantage that you came from the first world, which gives you a kind of glamour that the locals don't have. But that'll only get you so far if you don't have much talent or ambition. So yes, you can make a living as an artist down here, but know this, there are very few people that can actually make a good living at being an artist. The fact is, there are so many artists putting out so much of a very similar product that it's an absolute buyer's market down here. You can get artwork so cheap you wouldn't believe it. Sometimes it seems like you could buy a framed piece of artwork for not much more than it costs to make the frame. There's that much competition, and the prices, well, they've been bid down so low. And that's especially so within the artist community of indigenous Indians. All their artwork seems to fall into a certain category, an unmistakable look that gets copied over and over and over again. And because that stuff sells big in tourist areas, and it's very inexpensive compared to what you'd pay in the first world, you have to realize that is going to be your competition, so you'll have to keep your prices down accordingly. And listen to this. Once I was talking to a pretty good artist in a beach resort in Colombia, and he told me that only about 10 people he knew were making a decent living at art, and that was in a pretty swinging tourist area too. And he pointed out that sure, there were dozens and dozens of artists selling stuff around town, and in kiosks on the road to the beach. The real dope was that most of them had husbands or wives with second jobs to support the family, and the rest of them were still living at a parent or a relative's house. And that same guy told me that being an artist, even in a tourist area, is like being a musician. Even though there's a lot of clubs and a lot of live music around tourist areas, only a dozen or so musicians actually make a decent living at it. The other 50 or so musicians that actually play gigs once in a while, well, they're living from hand to mouth and still living with the parents or relatives too. So I guess my best advice for musicians and artists that come down here, unless you have a very unique product and are a great self-promoter, you better have a little cash in the bank and a plan B. Because when you come down here, you're probably not going to set the art world on fire.
South of the border.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Once again, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos.
South of the border.